You're listening to the Creepcast on DownrightCreepy.com. Now, here's your creepy host.
Welcome to the Creepcast. I'm Casey Canton along with Adam Roberts, and it's been a while since we've done a Creepcast. We've had a lot of interviews. Halloween has come and gone. How are you feeling over there?
I feel like I haven't seen you in I'm not seeing you right now, but I haven't seen this microphone with your fake face on the other side of it for a very long time. I don't know if you know this, Tim. I have a tiny printout of you across from me.
Yeah, I have one taped to my computer screen right now of myself, though. So that's weird.
Oh, cool. Well, I wonder if you, you need to have some point of context. You know, everyone's doing these. We don't do, I don't know why, but we don't do like Zoom or anything with faces. So we don't, you're probably thinking, why don't you just use a webcam that we have right in front of both of us? But we're not doing a webcam. We keep it old school, like a radio show.
Yeah. Why don't we do what we do normally when we're not talking to each other and we talk to other people on Zoom? I don't know. That's a great question.
But I like it.
Here we are. It's cool. You can't see the mustache that I'm starting to grow. So that's unfortunate.
I shaved mine off at the beginning of the month, but everything's growing back out. I'm starting to look a little unkept.
It's coming back. Well, it's November, so No Shave November is coming. But man, we got through October for some reason, felt like it lasted forever in a good way. And then the last like week of it just disappeared. Did it feel like that to you?
Yeah, I think the dumb election took away a lot of our fun in October, but it was still good. I watched a lot of movies, so
it just shut off October like real quick, I feel like, once the election started. But yeah, I mean, October, we had a ton of stuff. We had tons of interviews on the Creepcast. You guys had a ton of stuff at Screenland. Mm-hmm. And then we culminated it with Tricks or Treats.
I think that's also where our time went, Tim. I think our time went into this time suck of putting an online festival, which kind of was more, but also it was weird because we did so much work leading up to it.
Yeah.
And then it was like, unlike the real festival, which is like, oh, then we get to hang out and eat junk food and drink beer and like everyone's around us, we're all laughing, have a good time. It was like, because it was online, it was like, we were there, but it was only in a virtual sense. It didn't feel like being in person. So a lot of people have said like the virtual events have felt like the film fest, and we had, you know, ours was fairly well attended. Like it was about what we expected.
Yeah.
And people were interacting with stuff, but it's still like you're still interacting like the way you do when you go to work these days, if you work at home.
Right.
It wasn't the same. It wasn't like Panic Fest where we're all just like, you know, it's 48 hours or 7 days of just like you have tangible, I guess the tangibleness of being at a festival. There's so much that goes into it, like walking into all the theaters and there's, you know, the Panic Fest branding everywhere. And like, I don't know. It's just like it has
like more of a sense of community when you're in person.
Yeah.
You know, you organically leave the theater and you're talking about films. But we still wanted to do something kind of Panic Fest related and have it be fun for Halloween, not only for people that attend Panic Fest, go to Screenland, but also just for us to have something to do with, you know, Halloween kind of being shut down. It's not normal. So we did the Tricks and Treats Halloween Festival, for those of you maybe listening that don't know. It was over Halloween weekend. We had feature films, we had shorts, had a lot of events and panels. We even had a virtual kind of 8-bit space that you could go on Gather, where attendees could like explore rooms and talk to each other on camera, kind of recreating a lobby experience at Screenland a little bit. But yeah, we had tons of stuff for what was considered to be a smaller version of Panic Fest. Like looking back on it, thought we did like a really great job with the time frame we had and the constraints we had, and some of the people that helped us out with it was great. So yeah, I was excited by what we were able to do. And you know, if there's some of that stuff you missed, you can go find that online. And we even had, gosh, 3 blocks of shorts plus the Etheria shorts. So we had a lot of shorts, which is going to tie into our next topic today. We're going to review Shudder's Mortuary collection. But gosh, I wish that we we could have experienced Tricks or Treats with more people, just because I felt like we had a good time. But you're right, it was more lead time. Like, you know, we edited videos.
Yeah, I guess that's what felt different. It was like it was just such a buildup of like us sitting at a computer the whole time, putting it all together and recording stuff and making sure it looked and sounded great. And it was great. Like I, looking back, I'm like, holy shit, we did a lot for a three day, especially when the early bird tickets were $25. Like what?
Yeah.
Like, you end up getting too much. You literally couldn't even watch all the content we gave you. There was not enough hours in the weekend. So it was even like
VOD in a sense, you know, once you unlock something, you had a chance to watch it for a few hours, like a few days, even depending on when it was. So I like that aspect of it, that people had the chance to kind of follow along on our live schedule, or they could kind of create their own and mix and match, catch up later, which was cool. I think that's some of the good feedback we got. But I wanted to talk about, you know, if you missed the festival, I wanted to just highlight some things from it, including our short films and then a few features to look out for coming up. But we had three blocks of shorts and the Etheria shorts. So we technically had four. And it was a solid, pretty solid batch that we got submissions for. I wasn't really sure because it was going to be a shorter submission time frame. And, you know, are people making films during COVID? So we opened up the submission requirements and loosened them up compared to regular Panic Fest. We allowed it kind of any year. If you haven't submitted before, if you're a Panic alum, you want to resubmit again. And we got some great stuff. And the stuff I was going to highlight is actually all new things. Green Cobra was one. I don't know if you had a chance to watch that one or not. It was.
I did.
You did? Yeah, I thought it was fairly new, right? Like from what I remember, it was a newer short that hadn't screened very much.
I think that's correct. That was like a, not found footage, but kind of POV or something, right?
Yeah. It almost took like a office style, the POV office style of that, but had really rich photography and elements, and had a dark humor about it. It was a kind of crime thriller where they would torture people, interrogate them, and then they'd cut in and actually talk about the process in a more humorous way. But it was really unique, something that you don't often see at Horror Fest, especially it had more, like I said, the office angle to it. So that one's not out anywhere yet. But if you happen to see it on another festival circuit somewhere else, I highly suggest watching that.
Yeah.
10-13-12. This was a really trippy film that kind of kept you guessing and kind of satisfied the odd and curious part of your brain, because you didn't really know at times what you were watching, but I was still very intrigued by it. It had some very strange practical effect monster that felt like it was ripped out of almost a kid show, but still kind of creeped you out a little bit because it you didn't quite know what was going on. So I really love that. I believe that's actually available to watch too on Vimeo.
Yeah, it was great. It was a very like good mix of narrative and experimental filmmaking, I think. And
yeah.
Again, I think you nailed it by saying like, it's like a experience in a puzzle. And I think I would like to see them do a series based on that type of concept, because it was very satisfying to get to where it got to, but it was just so much fun. And I think at the end you felt like, oh, these people actually know what they're doing and they understand their subject really well.
Yeah, the way that they were kind of going in and out of the storytelling, in a sense, you could see it setting up a little like Mortuary Collection, which we'll get to in a minute, of how you could constantly just spin stories in and out of this almost fourth dimension that's happening. Then we had Asian She Competitive Morning that I loved. It was more of a music video format. That might have been one of my favorite ones, and I hadn't seen it, but it's actually been out since like 2017, 2018. Did you get a chance to check that out? Cause I thought that was awesome. Is that one? Cause I know you were handling some of the other stuff and
I
features.
I think I did see that. I watched most of them cause I had to watch them when I uploaded them to make sure that it wasn't screwed up.
Right. Yeah.
So they all kind of blurred in cause rather than usually we typically don't watch like 55 shorts in a row.
Right.
I did end up watching like over 3 days. I think every short in my head almost exploded watching them all.
And that one,
so I don't know if I remember that one quite much.
That one was essentially like a vampire that was attacking people. And it starts out with him attacking a girl in a parking lot at the beginning, and she gets away. and it becomes something where he's just like piling up bodies, but then goes back to his house and seemingly a normal man is what he looks appears as, and then comes home and finds her in the apartment for some revenge. It's a pretty short film. It's like 4 minutes, 6 minutes, I think. Oof. But it's great, and it plays out like a music video. Then I want to... Oh, go ahead. Did I cut you off?
Nope, you're good.
My bad. I wanted to touch on Together Till the End. It was a Spanish horror comedy.
Yeah, that one ruled.
Yeah, that was great, because it's really more comedy and relationships wrapped around a horror event, which ends up being a zombie outbreak.
Yeah, that one was fantastic.
And it was... it was more narrative driven, but it really is like, what would you do if you're stuck in a relationship, maybe even like during COVID, and you can't go out, and then a zombie outbreak happens, and now you're forced to kind of pick between your relationship or going out for help, in a sense. So I thought that was great. I don't believe that one's out to watch yet. And then the last one I wanted to touch on was Nova, which is a sci-fi film that's had a lot of acclaim. I actually got an email about this from a PR person that it's been on the circuit a ton of places, and I felt like it was up for a major award of some sort, not a leg lamp, but some sort of major award. And so that was one that is available online for you to check out. So those were just a few that stood out to me. Green Cobra, 10, 13, 12, Asian She, Competitive Morning, Together Till the End, and Nova. Those were all parts of our Tricks and Treats program that I wanted to highlight that I thought were really fun. Do you want to talk about features a little bit, like some of the stuff that we at least had maybe to look out for that's coming up?
Yeah. Our goal was to get 6 feature films. I think we ended up with 13 or 14.
Yeah, because we had, 5 that were submitted, and then we were able to, throughout our studio partnerships and other connections, we filled the roster up. Got beefy.
It got very beefy. So IFC Midnight continues their partnership with us here. We were the premiere of the new IFC Midnight film, which is available now on VOD, called Kindred. I really like Kindred. We also showed this in theater. I think this is like just right up my alley in terms of the types of films that I personally like. It's kind of a woman in trouble movie is what I call them. It's got hallucinations. It's a very beautifully shot film. Yes. It feels very like naturalistic in a lot of ways. And it's pretty damn creepy. It walks more of a mystery thriller angle. But it does have some great creepy vibes. There's some social political commentary in the background of it that I think people will really enjoy. And I believe it's the filmmaker's first film.
I think you're right about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I liked it quite a bit. The next one that I believe was a US or North America premiere is called Hunter Hunter. That one we got so late that I didn't even get to take a chance. They dropped it on us that week.
I was gonna say the trailer just came out for it this week. We put up on Downright Creepy. But yeah, it's coming out here in December, which is interesting because we got it, like you said, kind of late, and it's coming out fairly soon. So
yeah, so I don't know too much about that except for it has Devon Sawa and Nick Stahl in it, and that was enough for me. And like I said, I believe it was a premiere, maybe world premiere. And then we had The Vigil, which has had a lot of people know, I think, about The Vigil. It played at Fantasia. It was produced by Blumhouse. It's kind of it's been closest compared to like The Conjuring, with more of a Jewish background to the drop of what's happening. It follows this movie rules, and I can't wait to watch it. I want to watch it in a real audience, so hopefully that becomes a thing we could do, because it is very scary. And this one, unfortunately, doesn't come out until end of February, but maybe it'll play Panic Fest proper again next year, because it's one we could bring back, because it's a crowd. It's one that you will jump. It's like watching The Conjuring for the first time. It's a lot shorter than The Conjuring, which I like. But it follows a young man who has to do a duty where they look after a dead body over the course of a night. And it is very, very creepy. And yeah, I'm big fan of that.
That's and a then, perfect like segue. We'll get let's finish with Never Hike in the Snow, because I thought that was worth noting, because that is by Womp Stomp's Films, that has been doing the Friday the 13th fan films. It's actually out now that you can go watch on YouTube. It's about 30 minutes, a little over that. But it's, yeah, Friday the 13th fan film. They did Never Hike Alone. And now they have Never Hike in the Snow. And boy, they, even from the first one, from Never Hike Alone to this one, you can see the progression in kind of filmmaking, I feel like. And it's beautifully shot for a Friday the 13th type of film, and even more so for a fan film. And I cannot wait, and I hope they get a crack at the actual franchise, because I think they do a wonderful job.
Agreed. Yeah, their movies are great, and you can watch them for free.
Yeah, right. And yeah, we screened it as kind of a bonus, and they're like, here, have all the films we've done since they're already out. We put them on VOD so that way people could go enjoy them, but you can go on YouTube and check them out. And we actually had it in the Gather Town app too, the 8-bit town, that you could go in Theater One in our virtual Screenland theater and watch it with friends if you want to. It's still up there now. So yeah, it's kind of a fun fan film. But you're talking about the vigil where they have to watch over a dead body at night, mm-hmm. Which is perfect for the mortuary collection as a transition. So let's jump into our review of that right now. So Mortuary Collection is on Shudder, a Shudder exclusive, but not a Shudder original, if I recall, because, I mean, this was shot and then acquired by Shudder. Boy, I mean, we'll get into we'll do a deep dive into this, but man, I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, this movie, well, you know, speaking of Panic Fest, this was one that we had flirted with having at this year's Panic Fest as a premiere. But unfortunately, we thought it was going to happen, but unfortunately, during that time, they were also looking to sell the movie, and they ended up doing that. I also think it was still in effects at the time, but this movie has local ties, so the filmmakers are from the area.
Justin Ross, I believe. He's one of the producers, mm-hmm. Who has ties to the Kansas City area. He actually went to school with a friend of mine at Northwest Missouri State University. He was one of the producers on this. Let's set it up a little bit, but there's been a rise of, you know, horror anthologies over the past few years, and kind of paying homage to Tales from the Crypt or Creepshow or Tales from the Dark Side, Twilight Zone, which is, they're all more of anthology series that have had a revival. But then in recent years, we've had Scare Package, which screened at Panic Fest, and Deathcember that screened at Panic Fest, Tales of Halloween, of course, Trick or Treat, Southbound, just to name a few that have kind of risen to prominence among horror fans. So having this, you know, when you first hear anthology, you're like, oh, another anthology. But like you said, we wanted this for Panic Fest, but we already had Scare Package, we had December, and we had four short blocks, and we just couldn't get this one, unfortunately. And it's a bummer, because it turned out to be incredible.
Yeah. This movie ruled. It came out at the perfect time. I hope everyone who's listening to this, I think it's an anthology movie. It's pointless to even talk about them without kind of spoiling them. It's like talking about short films. They're so bite-sized. So I think if you're going to go forward from here, we're just going to consider a full spoiler discussion for Mortuary Collection. But
and it's out now. So yeah, go pause this. Go watch it on Shudder. It's about an hour and a half. Come back and listen to our discussion, talk to us on social about it, whatever. You're right. I mean, the nice thing about this is that it does have a connective universe and tissue, which isn't always the case with anthologies. Mm-hmm. But yeah, full on spoiler from this point on. I thought that the Mortuary Collection, as I mentioned all those before, kind of rose to the top, at least for me, in terms of recent ones that we've had, or even in maybe the last 10 years, kind of to the likes of Trick or Treat for me. It doesn't have that iconic character like Sam, but it was still great, because you could argue that Clancy Brown, who plays the mortician, the main character in this, one of the main characters in this, kind of is our Sam character in a sense, kind of carrying the mantle for us. But I guess we should set up the film a little bit in case people are interested.
Yeah. Do you want me to set this up? Or
sure. Yeah. Okay. If you want to, you don't. Yeah.
Go ahead. So the whole movie takes place in this pretty creepy town called Raven's End.
Yeah.
It's very, you know, this, I watched this and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark together, and it feels like they go very hand in hand together. And it was a great Scary Stories, while not exactly an anthology movie, is pretty damn close to that. But it follows a young girl who takes refuge in an old mortuary. She's let in pretty early on and in a fairly comedic scene. Mm-hmm. And then this is where she meets Montgomery Dark, who is this pretty wild undertaker there. And as you said, this is Clancy Brown, and under some good makeup, and he's incredible, but immediately he's creepy. You're like, who is this guy? Is he a Grim Reaper? Is he the devil? What kind of character is he? And then basically, similar to the movie, did we talk about Scare Me, or did you just do the interview?
No, we ended up just doing the interview.
Okay.
The
cast. Josh. But similar to that, it's the woman who arrives here is kind of like, she wants the job because there's been a sign outside in front of this place for so long, he's forgotten it even exists. And she's basically like, tell me all the stories, try to scare me from taking the job. And he sits, well, he doesn't really sit down. They go kind of room to room, and he tells her all the tales of the that are connected to this town and the mortuary itself. And kind of in like, I would say in like, like Tales from the Crypt, that something always mm-hmm. goes wrong for somebody that's doing something kind of bad. I think that's, is that it pretty much?
Yeah. I mean, that's, okay. That's a perfect setup. And I would just add to it that having a mortician is like a main character into an anthology.
How has that never been done?
I don't know, because that's a great entry point, because there's
is Tales from the Crypt, is the Crypt Keeper, he's kind of, I guess he's not a mortician, but he's a Crypt Keeper.
True, by
definition, I guess. So they would work hand in hand, right?
He's kind of the after, you know, he's in the graveyard watching the crypts, not preparing the people for their crypts. But man, what a great entry point into an anthology, a mortician character that has all this death around him and all these stories of people that have died. That he's essentially collected, like you said, in these books in his library as they're touring the mortuary, if you will, which is just a crazy house. It's like an old fashioned 1800s house. And Clancy Brown, that you mentioned, portrays Monty just in like a really exquisite way, like nails the role as our lead storyteller and mortician. And then you mentioned it was Caitlin Custer, ironically, plays Sam, which I mentioned Trick or Treat earlier.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's her name. And the babysitter is the other name, which we get to in a little bit. But an equally great co-star, in my opinion. And these two are carrying our stories from one thing to the next. We have four stories that get told, technically four and a half. And it's banter back and forth in between the cutscenes. But it's all done wonderfully and woven together wonderfully, and tees up really nicely. We got these four essential stories. Raven's Inn kind of creates this universe. And before we jump into the individual kind of shorts, I just wanted to take a moment to praise the art department, the set decoration. I felt like it created a really incredible kind of authentic world that they built and kind of laid out in front of us. So kudos to the AD, Harrison Chambers, Katie Simon and set dresser, Carly Engelbrecht. They don't usually get a shout out, I feel like, for films. And I thought I would bring that up because everything felt very, had a great continuity to it, mm-hmm. Which you don't always see in anthologies, because they're kind of like one-off films. And, you know, someone did this piece and then another director did this piece, and they don't always tie together. But since this lived in the same universe, it had to match. And I thought it was great.
And before we move on there, this movie is pretty fascinating. So the roots, the story in here, the Babysitter Murders, mm-hmm. actually was a short film made by Ryan and company in 2015, I believe, as a proof of concept for this. And then they actually did a Kickstarter, and I don't know if the Kickstarter was exactly for that. I think it was for the whole series, but they did that in late 2014. But I believe the Babysitter Murders had already been shot, and they raised a little over 60 grand for that. And then of course, with the short film success and the Kickstarter money, they were able to get some more money, but they filmed this over, I believe, 4 years altogether on weekends. And I kind of patched this together with friends and family and whoever could donate. So if you look at the cast or in the crew, you'll see credit. Most people are almost, you know, one person in all the positions, but every once in a while you see like four or five in certain positions, because it took them a long time and a lot of locations and a lot of people to really complete it. You know, I think the wraparound story with Clancy Brown at the main location, I think that was all filmed together, but the rest of the stories were filmed, you know, over years. So it is pretty fascinating when you look at this, because it all flows so perfect. You would never know this wasn't that. And I believe their final budget was well under $500,000. And if you look at, I mean, this movie is dripping with aesthetics and effects, and they're just unbelievable. So just from, you know, even if you're not an anthology person or don't like shorts or this doesn't interest you, you should watch it with the sound off just to see what they were able to achieve for, you know, a sub-million-dollar movie that's just absolutely eye-popping and gorgeous.
Yeah, I actually didn't know much of the backstory behind it that you just told. So that's awesome to hear. I had a hunch that was the case in terms of like kickstarting it. I wasn't sure to what extent. And I only say that because as the credits rolled, you get to special thanks and there's a ton of people, which immediately made me think they were Kickstarter rewards in a sense. But I did not know about the time frame that it was filmed over, and to keep that continuity over a time frame like that is pretty remarkable. And like you said, it's dripping in aesthetics. I mean, there was times when we get to the social commentary, when kind of the female empowerment, the second one that we'll get to in a minute, but you see the wallpaper on the background of a nursery, and I was like, man, that's a fucking creepy wallpaper back there with like children's kind of illustrations, but it feels very macabre. The whole thing feels macabre and it's wonderful. So it's great that you were able to tell that story, because I didn't personally know it, so I learned something new.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, I think, that they were able to do that and keep it so consistent. I mean, that's the hardest thing. It's just like even a regular movie, just like keeping the tone, and they did such a good job here in keeping that tone and making it feel like a singular film. And I mean, if nothing else, like I always like to watch movies that were made for very little over a long period of time, and this movie is just I think one of the best examples of what you can do when you really put your mind to it and really really sat down and planned out and get it done. But yeah, I mean, they've took a long ass time to make this movie.
And assuming, you know, there's not a lot of these stories, especially the kind of second one, includes so many people. There's a lot of people involved in this. It wouldn't be cheap, unless it was a labor of love for a lot of the people involved. And I'm sure it was for the actors. But landing Clancy Brown in that main role was incredible for the budget that they probably had to work with. It helps that he's kind of throughout the movie and not in one specific short, but it also, once you pull those kind of wraparound cutscenes, he really probably is in a short at that point. He's in the movie quite a bit. So should we dive into the first one, which I'm titling The Monster in the Mirror, the short that kind of sets up our kicks things off for us. So this one out of all of them felt less connective in the universe, but it was the first story that Monty is telling Sam, because Sam's like, oh, tell me these stories. She's there to technically, we think, apply for a job at the mortuary, because there's a help wanted sign that's been up for quite some time at the Raven's Inn mortuary, and she walks in wanting a job. And so he starts to share tales with her from the job to kind of see if she's up for it, I think. And she immediately kind of mocks him that, you know, it's not going to be scary or nice try, that kind of thing, when she's telling the stories. And this is the first one we get, which has a theme that we see throughout, where there's female empowerment in some way, shape, or form in every short, starting with this one.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel obvious, I think. what they're trying to do with that empowerment, with that like perspective. But yeah, that monster, I think this was a good story to start with. I think it's quick. It's gory.
Yeah.
And it's fun. I mean, it is the shortest of all the stories, so it is a good little one. And it's just it opens it up for like, oh shit, what is the budget of this? I mean, you get to the
right.
You start in the house, but then once you get to the Monster in the Mirror story, it's pretty fantastic, I think.
It was a great primer to set up, I felt like, what they could do. And from a storytelling standpoint of the Mortician, to kind of give something that's like, oh, if this is the one that's not as scary or intense, like, what are we in store for the next ones? And all this takes place in, what would you say, like the 50s, 60s?
It's definitely like Don Draper's time frame.
Yeah, and it involves a lady that's at a party, and she goes into the bathroom. I'm a little unclear exactly what was happening.
I think she's a pickpocket or of some kind of grifters. She's definitely there, like, doing some criminal activity.
Yeah, at a party, and there's a guy that's, like, knocking on the door, and she's like, oh, I'll meet you up in the room in, like, 10 minutes, and she's in the bathroom. And we see her starting to dig through the garbage and find wallet after wallet of men taking the money out, and then she's about ready to leave and notices, like, oh, there's a medicine cabinet here. Maybe there's something, you know, hidden in here that I can take. And once she opens it, she realizes she never should have and wants nothing more than to keep it closed, because we find out there's something lurking in it, which ends up being this almost like Demogorgon octopus type of character. And man, the effects on it were great. Just slimy, something straight out of the Thing. But great effects, whether it was some of it had to be practical and then some of it had to be digital, it felt like. But really blurred the line between those two.
Yeah, it was a great sequence. Yeah, she gets pulled into the mirror, kind of had like House vibes, what was ever on the other side of this medicine cabinet. But again, short and to the point, sets us up quickly for what kind of movie this is going to be.
Yeah, and then we kind of quickly get into the snarkiness of Sam and Monty, and you see that relationship starting to build and take form before he's like, oh, that wasn't scary enough for you. Let's get into the next one, which is really more of social commentary, kind of cautionary tale. And we really start to see a narrative that's carried throughout the rest of them with the female empowerment piece, starting with this one that includes kind of a frat bro culture at a college, a cautionary tale of, you know, unprotected sex, STDs, and then role reversals that come about. And it's got a lot of ebbs and flows in it.
Yeah, this one's awesome. It's another ooey gooey one, but this one, I don't know what the time is on this one, but it just the cast is incredible. It's got the I can't remember his name. It's the jerk from Euphoria. He's great in this. He's
Jacob,
kind of our,
Jacob Elord. Elordi. That's what his name is.
He's our main person we're following here, and he's, you know, handing out condoms, telling everybody to practice safe sex, and then of course he doesn't do it himself. Like, he fake puts a condom on while having sex and throws across the room, even though she says, you know, make sure you wear the condom. And then next morning, you know, of course he's got some kind of STD rash, and then things get crazier and crazier. Of course he's, you know, they're celebrating him having sex with like 60 some women and you know, throwing them up and on their shoulders and like partying in this frat. And then, you know, he has water breaks or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. During the like chair celebration, the water burst out. But I was going to mention too, like, he gets approached at the beginning when they are doing the condom thing, right? The whole frat boy, we're going to have a party, you know, make sure you have sex. You'll feel, he literally is talking about female empowerment by putting on a condom.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was a little weird, but then he approaches what seems like this dorky girl that he ends up having sex with, but she's actually really attractive. So I don't know why they took an angle of like, she's supposed to come off kind of dorky, but she also felt like she might be part of like Charles Manson's cult.
Her vibe.
She gives you that vibe like right before they're having sex. And yeah, they hook up at that party, like you mentioned, and I laughed when it was like 7 hours of sex. you see the clock flipping through on the nightstand from midnight to 7 a.m. And like that alone, I felt like should have been a red flag. And also like you shouldn't have an erection longer than 4 hours. So all of that seemed strange to me. I don't know if that's his normal routine. And then, like you said, he gets that rash, but then celebrates the sex with his frat brothers. He, when he gets that rash and you said his water burst, because we find out, that he's actually pregnant, mm-hmm. which was an angle I kind of felt like was coming. Did you see something like that coming at least?
Yeah.
I mean, it was telegraphed, but it was still entertaining.
I
felt okay like either going to be a monster that she had somehow put in him or a child, which ends up being both. But I really want to call out the doctor, which is Harold Kubler, who is played by Mike C. Nelson, who has a face that I felt like I've seen in many things before. Did you feel that way? Didn't he feel familiar?
He feel, yeah, his, or maybe it's his portrayal. Something was similar, yes.
But we end up seeing this character carried out throughout the anthology, which is part of the universe and world building within. But yeah, we have the water burst, kind of fast forwarding to the diagnosis. He thinks something's wrong. Apparently he's pregnant, and then he immediately wants to call this girl to figure out like, what the hell have you done to me? Which we get a revelation later on at the house.
I mean, I guess we get to this point to where, you know, he comes in, he's like begging her for help, and her parents are there and they're like, come down here, get your ass down here. And she comes down. And of course, like they explain basically whatever, you know, happened. And
yeah, then like, his dick explodes. It again.
And then blah, 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 blah. His dick explodes and a baby comes out.
Yeah, because he's sitting there and it's like clearly these parents of this woman that he's had sex with has dealt with this before. Because like you mentioned, they're like, oh, what have you done? And so they know how to handle the situation. And he's freaking out because, you know, his veins are popping out of his neck. He's got a big belly at this point, which progressed very fast, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was
I like strange. How fast it progressed.
Yeah. It had to be within a week. It felt like, which makes sense for a short, but there's nothing that would have showed time passage other than the fact that he had gotten a larger belly. And yeah, he goes, well, how is this going to work? Asking the dad, and the mom's like, well, it's going to come out the same way it went in. And his dick explodes, blah, 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 blah. So, I wasn't expecting the dick exploding. It was,
I didn't think we were gonna get the shot. I better thought we were gonna get something like it falling out of his wiener, and just not everything they did there was going to be painful for anybody with a wiener.
It did make me a little not queasy. It made me uneasy watching it, waiting for exactly how the baby was going to come out.
Yeah.
It made me squirm a little bit, probably even more so as a male. But so, yeah, that one ends exactly how it sounds. But then the twist, or somewhat twist, is the fact this is clearly happened before.
The like 12 babies upstairs in their cribs.
Yeah.
As she's going out on the prowl for another night.
Yeah, because they wrap it up, they put it in the crib, and you're like, okay, this seems way too normal for them. And they walk away and, you know, steps on like a dog toy, and all the babies wake up and you're like, oh shit. And you realize that they're not human either. There's kind of a claw that comes up. And while he's in delivery, the woman he had sex with is like on the phone making her next date. So
yeah,
I don't know to what extent the end goal is here, or like the parents saying, hey, knock that shit off. But yeah, there's all these demon babies upstairs that they've basically harvested from these kids. And she mentions before, like, there's a serial killer on campus. Aren't you scared that I might be him or be that? And jokingly. So kind of foreshadowing that, but man, an uneasy one, but, social commentary, just dripping in social commentary. Do you want to set up the next one?
Sure. So the next story I believe is in the 1970s now. So I guess we went 50s, 60s, 70s here.
Good point. Yeah.
And it follows, a man who's, this story is just a bummer kind of until it gets to this weird hypnotic kind of stage of it. But, he's just kind of this slog of a person who's taking care of his comatose wife. He's, you know, just that's all he does is like pay all the bills, you know, hand feed her, you know, put her in bed, you know, all the things that like nobody wants to deal with. As a young person, they're both, I think, supposed to be pretty newly wedded couple.
Yeah, fairly.
And so his doctor comes to check on her, and he basically, like, the doctor suggests that he could accidentally overdose her, wink, wink, if he were to give her too many of these painkillers, no one will notice.
Same doctor.
He tries to give them to her, and, you know, he's like, she's not dying. And he's just like, he's upset, and it's not going the way he thought. And then she grabs his arm and, like, kind of seemingly snaps out of it. And wakes up, and I'm trying to remember what exactly happens in this throw up and this headbutt thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, she's been in a coma for like months at this point, with whatever sickness that she's had. So he's had to, you know, every meal that he's made, he's blended up in the blender and had to spoon feed her for every meal. You know, put her medicine in that, which when the doctor does come and give her the, you know, the magic pills, the painkillers that you mentioned, he's like, I'll just add it to the pile of stuff, and didn't even think about it until the doctor's like, no, do you hear what I'm saying? If she takes more of these, it for some reason wouldn't be detected, which I thought was weird.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it would. It's like toxicology. Even back then they had that. That they would find it. But anyway, so he decides to see if, you know, she'll snap out of this coma. Will she respond to him to see if it's still worth, you know, is she a vegetable, basically? Like, is she really there causing it? And that's when he gives her the pills that you mentioned. And it's supposed to be like clean, cut and dry, right? Like, it's supposed to be kind of over after that. And he doesn't have to be the caretaker anymore, which is really weighing on his financial situation, his mental stability. And then we get kind of the kicker. He got this hair for her. It was it was a statue, and it was a rabbit that she likes to collect rabbits, apparently, and sets it in front of her. She doesn't react, obviously. But when she takes those medicine, you know, she just falls flat because she's basically passed out and lands headfirst into this rabbit. This metal rabbit, and it sticks into her head, and it's pretty gruesome. And the whole point was that this was going to be undetectable, and it looks like she died natural causes. And now you've got that comedic aspect that's come back into play, that you kind of get in and out of, even with these kind of gruesome or like depressing moments. And you've had a woman that's been in a coma this whole time, but in the end, because when this happens, it turns out she's not, apparently, completely brain dead. We have another female empowerment story that you didn't see coming. In a way, she's kind of controlled him, not purposely, through a coma and her disease, and then right when he thinks he has an out, in this case, she kind of comes back and says, not so fast, and in a sense haunts him in real time.
Yeah, which this is, so this story was like, first couple actually are also fast paced. So when we get to this part, it feels a little bit, what's the word? It feels, this one definitely to me feels the most like a Tales from the Crypt episode.
Yeah.
And this one, the turn it takes when it gets into the elevator, when he's, you know, it's that moment where you're like, why didn't you just call the cops? It was an accident. You know, her head fell into this thing. She died. but of course he doesn't, he cuts her body parts up. He shoves her in her trunk and tries to drag her out.
Boy, that's gruesome too.
Yeah. And then once you get into the elevator, there's so much weird, like almost hallucinogenic, like paranoia vibe happening as he's like sweating to get the elevator down. And then things just get wild in this like haunted elevator experience, and sad as the haunting continues. I think while I was watching this, I was like, oh, this is my least favorite. But once we got to the end, I was like, that story was very good and very different and felt very timeless, I think, and very much like a book.
I felt the same way. It's the slowest burning of all of them, I felt like. If you can say that for shorts, it's probably, I mean, all these are around between kind of a 10 to 20 minute runtime. And this one kind of unfolds, but it's, it's more isolated than the other ones because it's really just two people with a doctor involved, and it is more slow pace and a build up. But then when it gets to the end, like you said, in the elevator, it becomes otherworldly by the very end of it. Mm-hmm. And you almost don't know what's happening.
The end's
kind of strange, right? Like,
the end is very weird and strange, but like when they like hit a free fall and the elevator starts just going nonstop down to the final
like hell.
Yeah. And it seems to go for eternity, and they like, they're both like floating in the air, and I'm like, holy shit, this is insane.
The shot in there.
Yeah.
The slow motion shot of when kind of blood starting to oddly drip upward, I thought was pretty incredible, but it also played out to me like an Edgar Allan Poe story would.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the most tale, like Tales from the Crypt. Like, to me, it felt like a Poe story, modernized, or as much as you can, set in the 70s. But yeah, I thought it was great. Maybe at the end we can kind of like even rank our stories of which ones we liked best.
Yeah, I think that's a good way. But because that's kind of the climax here. Like, the cops show up at the end, and he's repeating his vows over and over again. And he's there with her body, and that's pretty much it, right?
Yeah, let's get into the last one, the babysitter murders, which...
Well, so wait, we need to talk about the because you get a little bit more of the real story, the framework here. The girl, Sam, is complaining about the story, saying they're very predictable and they follow the same thing of people being punished for their sins, blah, blah, blah. And then she says that she's not there for a job. She's actually there for this child-sized coffin that he's planning to cremate. And she begins to tell her it's time for him to be told a story, is what she says. And that takes us to the last segment, which is the babysitter murders, which is a nice nod to the original title of Halloween, John Carpenter's Halloween. Yep. This was the original short story that they made, a short film they made for the movie. So take it away, Tim.
Well, I was going to say that the Halloween nod is obvious, even if you don't know the babysitter murders tie-in, because we start inside a different world that I think is going to be the short, which actually ends up being a TV movie, or just a movie that she's watching on TV. And it's got the nod where Jamie's character would be talking on the phone to her friend and she's babysitting, and there ends up being a murderer on the loose. I mean, it's very, you know, Michael Myers Halloween like, and homage to that without being too heavy handed. But it's obvious that they're paying homage to that right off the bat. And then it slowly pulls out of the TV, to reveal that, our main character, Sam, who's the one telling the story to the mortician, we're now seeing her story that she's telling, and she's the babysitter watching the babysitter murderers film that's on TV. We even see the title treatment come up and all that kind of stuff. And you're like, whoa, this is becoming very meta very quick.
Yeah.
Then we get into her kind of experience of babysitting, but we never see the kid because the kid's asleep. So she's doing what, you know, every babysitter does, just kind of has run of the house. And she gets a call that she doesn't pick up about the parent. Well, actually, she checks the voicemail, which is kind of funny to say back that long ago, and finds out the parents will not be home on time. So just help yourself to whatever's in the house. So everything's seemingly normal, but you know it's going to be building up to something. And you kind of get the foreshadowing on the TV show on the screen every now and then throughout.
Yeah, and that takes us to this is like the...
It's kind of
like, does the like power go out? Or the phone? No, you got that. The phone didn't ring. It's like the power goes out or something happens, or like lightning strikes or something. And then a strange man like arrives in the kitchen.
Well, she's in the kitchen when she hears that, oh yeah, you can have run of the house, cook dinner, eat whatever you want from the parents
right. But in the background, we hear that there's somebody escaped from a local asylum,
which again ties back into, you know, Halloween.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a news report, a break in that like a local asylum patient has broken out, and you start hearing about the details of it. Like, here's what they look like. They typically find babysitters to prey on, or, you know, kill. They also kill the children that they're watching, and they eat them. They're cannibals. And you're like, good Lord. So, I mean, that in the background just playing while she's kind of playfully cooking dinner is some foreshadowing in itself.
Yeah. So then you get this man with a bandage on his head, bleeding, that doesn't know how he got there, what's going on. And then it's like, oh shit, this guy is like the escape man. He's going to hurt her. And then there's a struggle. And then that leads upstairs, right? Like he went upstairs.
Yeah. The struggle is interesting because we get kind of a fight scene between them as he finds out because the parents call again and leave a message and they're like, what are you doing? Are you safe? There's a killer on the loose. He hears all this, right? And then they're like, make sure that, I think Jacob maybe is the kid's name. And they're like, make sure he's safe. And that's when the killer, the man, I should say, hears all that. And he's like, oh, there's a kid here. I'm going to go find him. That's when they rush upstairs and this fight scene that you were talking about takes place. And much like the elevator scene was done really well and like crafted really well, because the power does go out at that point. And now they're, you know, kind of the cliche, the lightning strikes, thunder goes, and the lights go out. And you've got a killer and the babysitter, and then a kid hidden in the room somewhere who likes to hide, according to the parents. But the fight choreography that happens, it's slow motion. It's lit by only lightning strikes, much like you might have like cameras flashing in a paranormal film that adds some tension to it. And that's kind of when you see the fight take place, is just during these lightning strikes. And I thought that was crafted really well too.
Yeah, no, I love it.
Then we get to a big twist.
So, yeah, and then the big twist, of course, here is that this man is not the killer. It's, in fact, her that's the killer.
Which actually really did get me.
Yeah, for sure. Like, because it happens so quick.
Yeah, there's not a lot of buildup to be like, oh, I can see this coming.
Yeah.
And she becomes the final girl, right? Like Jamie Lee and that last scene where the murderer, you know, Michael Myers is laying outside the window or something like that. She crushes this guy's skull in with the TV, which is still working. And that was a great shot. You know, you see kind of a point of view from the TV perspective of it slamming into his face. And since it's glass, we see his face just kind of collapse into just mush. Then the culmination of the doctor being in the story comes full circle, because you find out that it's his house. It's the doctor's house, and the wife, they were the ones out. They're coming home and the door's locked. They can't get in. They notice that something has happened. Someone's laying in the front living room with the TV smashed on it. And they lift the face up. They're like, who do you think it is? And the doctor's like, it's the babysitter. And I'm like, what? It's the babysitter. The man's the babysitter. And that's the twist that happens. And I totally didn't see it coming. Maybe I'm naive, but
I think they bury it so well.
What a great twist.
Yeah. And then you get the doctor then. The doctor comes home, and then the TV calls her like the tooth fairy killer.
Yeah.
From dead children. And then they find that their kids remains wasn't asleep. It's dead in the oven. That's what she was cooking.
Yep, the whole time. Because she also eats the children, we find out. Yeah. So the news report that mentioned, you know, they kill the babysitter, they kill the kid, they eat the kid, and they take teeth. All the boxes get checked in that kind of one scene that's no more than, you know, 60 seconds. Hits you with that twist kind of right across the face, which I loved. I thought that was great.
Yeah, and then that takes us back to the mortuary where she finishes the story, and then she goes and takes out the kid in front of her's tooth, who is the charred kid that she didn't have a chance to steal tooth from.
Yeah, as like a token of killing him. And she does this with everyone. That's why she's called the Tooth Fairy. She collects all these teeth. We get back, and Monty is just kind of like slightly unfazed by it, because, you know, he's experienced and seen so many things. He's a mortician, so he's not entirely shocked. And then, you know, she steals the tooth, pushes the body into the incinerator, which is, she stopped him when she starts telling the story and says, hold on, this is my fault that he's here. Let me tell you why. As if she feels guilty and needs to get it off her chest. But in reality, she's like, hold on, I need that tooth and I will finish the job that I started. Which then we get some revenge and more backstory on what actually lies within this house, which is the library.
Yep. And then from there, there's like a, there's a little bit of a they like have a little bit of a chase, and the library or the mortuary itself starts falling apart. And she's trying to get out and
stuck in like a time loop, essentially.
Yeah, like she like can't get out for whatever reason. And then the spirits of all the people that she's killed, or the kids she's killed, or people she's harmed, begin to like crawl out of the books from the library, and then they catch up with her and rip her up to pieces.
Yeah, it's interesting because as he's standing upstairs in the library, and she's, you know, went round and round trying to get out of this house that feels like a time loop portal where she just runs out, but then she immediately is back in. He's like, well, where are we? What is this place? She's trying to figure out what's happening. He goes, well, we're in a library. So again, bringing like a little comedy poke back in. But when she says, you know, we're in a library, he goes, well, actually, a lot of these stories are yours. And the books start flying off the shelves.
Yeah, and, that's what it was.
You know, they're illustrated kind of stories here and there to remind you what it was about as a visual aid. And some of the stories, as the books fly open, have illustrations of kids that she's murdered or scenes from the murders. And that's when the burnt charred kids climb and burn their way out of the books, which was a great scene. And clearly, you know, CGI driven, but nothing that took you out of the moment. They're kind of glowing embers, but they're very black. Some have some teeth, some are missing teeth. And that's when they all kind of go in and surround her. And like you said, start attacking and chewing at her and clawing at her. And they actually, some of the teeth fall out of her pocket, spill. They start picking them up, putting them back in their mouths, which I love that scene. I'm not a big CGI person, but when it works, it works. And, essentially, you know, the help wanted sign that's been on the Raven's Inn mortuary in the front for years, because we find out that he's really, I think, from the 1800s, and he's been cursed with the mortuary. And he's really trying to pass on this curse to someone else, which he's found someone fitting of a storyteller as he was.
Yeah. And I mean, that's pretty much where
it kind of wraps up.
Yeah. It ends like, obviously, yeah, where we're like, oh, she's the new person. And, you know, ends with like a cute little scene of her talking to a kid and hopefully getting them to stay for dinner. But now she's an mortician. I'm like, fuck, I want a second one where she's at now. I'd love to go down this path again. I think stylistically it was just so much fun. I think the stories are well told. They're scary. The effects are great. And that they have their tongue firmly planted in their cheek in a way that I think not many movies can pull off. So yeah, I think it was great.
It was one of the more impressive, I mentioned this at the top of the show a little bit, but more impressive anthologies that I've seen in a long time, the way that they wrap the universe together into a bow and a package at the end. I would say maybe even since Trick or Treat, which plays out differently, you know, as a more seamless anthology, versus something that's very much in and out of stories. That one plays out a little bit more seamless, but I can't praise this film enough for how it was made. And I feel like it's almost in the same spirit a little bit as Trick or Treat, where it's something that, you know, in this day and age isn't going to get a theatrical release, but man, could you see this coming out at like on Halloween if it would have been in theaters?
Oh man. Yeah,
I mean, people would have loved it. It would have been perfect. It's the perfect Halloween type movie for people that are even, you know, casual horror fans. So it's a little unfortunate that it only gets put on Shudder, but it is on Shudder and it's available for everyone to check out. I strongly suggest checking it out. And let's get into our final ratings for this. Out of 100%, I'm going to give it 95, which is one of the higher ratings I've given a film in a while.
That's what a perfect score for a person like you.
Yeah, pretty much. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm in that 95% just because, man, you know, yeah, 95%, only because that third story with the man and his wife I like it. I don't love it as much as the other ones. It kind of slows the pace a tiny bit. But that's what you get with an anthology film. And for to go this successful with it, I think it deserves the praise. I think directing wise, stylistically, like art direction, all that is just such an achievement. So yeah, 95% for me.
And the Rotten Tomatoes, the critics had it at 95%, which is kind of ironic.
Look at us. We're perfect.
I actually put my rating in too before I even knew that. The audience has had it at 79, which is actually still pretty high for Rotten Tomatoes, I feel like.
Yeah,
so,
for those haters.
Universally, you're setting it, you know, an average of maybe 85 on that. Which one was your favorite and which one was your least favorite? I already know your least favorite was the coma till death do us part. Which was your favorite?
I thought the Babysitter Murders was going to be my favorite. It's maybe my second favorite. I think my favorite actually might be the baby one.
Really? Yeah. The social, I was calling it Karl Marx cause they opened it up that way. Yeah. Female empowerment one. For me, I would never include the Monster in the Mirror cause it's short. And I did enjoy it actually. My favorite actually is the Babysitter Murders. I just love kind of the homage to Halloween and how it tied everything back together. My least favorite actually probably was the one that you thought was your favorite. It's not that I didn't like it. It just didn't do quite as much for me as the other ones. But yeah, it was just kind of probably my least favorite out of those. So they're all great. And it's almost unfair to even say, which was your least favorite? Cause I enjoyed the whole thing, especially when we give it such high ratings. So yeah, check out the Mortuary Collection. It's a Shudder exclusive/original. it's streaming right now. I think a lot of you have probably already seen it. It was probably on your October watch list. But if not, I implore you to go watch it maybe over Thanksgiving as you stay home. Hopefully shelter in place or shutter in place, if you will. Let's talk about, of course, you can always find us on social media if you want to join the conversation about this. Hashtag Creepcast or at CreepcastPod, at Downright Creepy. You can rate and review the podcast on Spotify, on Apple, iTunes, Anchor FM, anywhere you listen to podcasts. Please rate and review or share the show with friends. It's going to help us out and move up the rankings, hopefully. So also go check out Adam's podcast, Nightmare Hour. Of course, there's screenlandonline.com. You can go rent a movie this weekend, support your indie theaters here in Kansas City. Even if you're not in Kansas City, you can do that and support your own local ones as well. So is there anything else you want to add about upcoming events at Screenland or some online events for Patreon?
No, I don't think so at this time. But yeah, we're doing a lot more watch parties now. I'm kind of revamped the rental site. There's some great films coming out, some great genre movies coming out that you're going to be able to rent from there. Some of them are on there right now. But yeah, as we head into this quote unquote dark winter, find as many ways you could to help theaters around you.
Of course, not only Screenland Online, but you have a Patreon that people can find and donate to as well. So
yeah, and like we do virtual trivia every week. So I the cost of the Patreon for a month's subscription is between $5 and $30, whatever you want to do. There's plenty of entertainment up there for you. We do a weekly podcast, weekly trivia, then we do watch parties a couple times a month. So there's anywhere from like 8 to 20 events we do throughout the month. Pretty good amount of events.
Something for everyone. You can check out our other podcast too on the Crickets Podcast Network here on Downright Creepy, Black Magic Coven and Super Creepy Funtime Hour that I host with Genius McGee from Nightmare Junkhead. And we're just kind of a silly podcast where we put ourselves in odd situations. It's a little scripted storytelling type of thing. That's a good time. So check those podcasts out. Support your local theaters. Let's try and get through this and hashtag save your cinema. I believe that's what we're going with. I hope we can get back to this on a little more regular schedule. Of course, October just kind of kicked our ass with everything. And we'll get back probably in another week or two with another episode and give you some more movie recommendations. You got anything else to add?
No, I think that's it. We're back, baby.
Back. All right, everyone, stay creepy, stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Listening to a Downright Creepy original on the Crickets Podcast Network.